This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hey, my name is Alice Wong, and I'm the host of the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. Today's episode is about advocacy, intersectionality, and mental health with Victoria Rodriguez-Roldan. Victoria is the director of the Transgender Nonconforming Justice Project and the Disability Justice Project at the National LGBTQ Task Force. You're going to hear us get really real about social justice, the politics of hypervisibility, the toxic aspects of activism, transgender mental health, and healthcare discrimination. Are you ready? Away we go.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Victoria, I guess, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background, if you like.
I grew up in Puerto Rico, originally. I initially wanted to be a psychologist, of all things, considering all my mental illnesses, that is interesting. I very quickly grew disillusioned with academia. I very quickly became involved in activism and was the first trans person in student government at the UPR. Ended up helping broker a student strike that was all in the media, political campaigns, and so on. And doing law school at that point, there's this whole stereotype that if you want to be in politics, you go to law school, pretend to be a lawyer, and go into that.
How would you identify yourself? If somebody asked you, one or two sentences, how would you describe yourself or identify?
Mm-hmm.
If that helps.
Polyamorous, lesbian, trans woman, Puerto Rican, bipolar, very proudly so at this point, closeted at one point. And I see myself in a way, not just when I talk about activism, I like to say that I don't see it as like LGBT advocacy or disability advocacy or fill in the blank advocacy, but as overarching a single social justice slash progressive slash justice in general advocacy, basically, since I believe you cannot do any one of these without the others, basically.
What are your thoughts about all these people that, you know, actually mock people who are in social justice? This whole, you know, that term, you know, social justice warrior. I mean, I find it really, you know, disappointing that people don't realize that social justice is absolutely important.
Yeah.
It's not about being politically correct.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not just the whole not being politically correct. Often even within the very left, even within social justice spaces, we commit the mistake of trying to be too simplistic about it, about everything essentially, where take the term, for example, respectability politics, and we will go from everything to dismissing the concept, which is in and of itself dangerous. It's in and of itself dismissing the harm the issue does, to essentially calling any sort of act of relative politeness respectability politics, and then you're cheapening the concept. And the problem is we do that a lot with other issues like privilege, for example. Sometimes I feel that whoever talks the most about privilege the most understands it the least, or social justice in general. Intersectionality is often reduced to a buzzword to, oh, we have black people in the room, we are intersectional.
And also, I think erasure is another term that's used a lot,
but
that's not really kind of interrogated as well as it should be.
Yeah.
And I do think that intersectionality is it's such an important concept, but it's really about, I think, as Kimberly Crenshaw, the person who coined it, you know, talked about, it's really about power dynamics. It's not about diversity in terms of, you know, what we think about as diversity. It's really about situational, relational politics.
The problem is, when it comes, for example, diversity or achieving that, is that diversity, as it's often ends up being practiced, ends up being, say, white people trying to decide what is diverse, basically. It ends up being boiled down to the perfectly genetically engineered college brochure that magically always has every single possible minority inside the picture of people happily studying. So in that sense, like, diversity as it is often practiced is basically becomes that. People with the power trying to decide what it looks like themselves. Diversity is the word. That's the proper term. Mm-hmm. The problem is who is trying to define it, who is trying to look at it and say, well, yes, we need to do it, and this is how we will do it. And that problem applies in many ways to everything from, as you were saying, SJW and other terms there. So, yeah. So that entire pressure that exists everywhere from the classrooms to, Jesus Christ, as disabled people, every single medical space we inhabit. And this is especially as a trans person who is routinely having to very clearly realize that I'm probably the first trans person they've ever met in a very, very long time. It creates that pressure where it's not even the whole you're expected to speak out for yourself or whatnot, but essentially you carry the weight of the entire image, especially, and this happens in all marginalized spaces, but if the entire perception of them as to whether disabled people can be people basically relies on your being, and you're leaving a good impression on them, that you're not a dick, basically.
Disabled people should be able to be assholes.
Exactly.
I do think that that's where the politics of visibility and the risks. I mean, there are risks to be out and proud and disclose everything about yourself, because it does expose you to these kind of scrutiny. And these kind of unfair kind of expectations.
Yes. I can't speak as much for physical disabilities, but in the case of mental health disabilities, of developmental disabilities, of the above-the-neck variety of disabilities, there is the pressure of, since the entire perception of everyone who has never met someone who is bipolar before you is those crazy people, or dad, somebody's uncle who went psychotic one day and they institutionalized him, and we don't talk about that type of experience, then you turn into, it's almost like the inverse of the model minority, where you're the model of said minority, and thus any screw up that you make is essentially hurting that entire community, because you're what people think of, comes up to their minds when they think of that disability, especially when in disabilities where your entire character is being called into question due to it. Just the case in mental health disabilities, where you're having to break continuously that, yes, I am here. Yes, I look just like you. I'm not sitting in a corner muttering random things. And even if I did, I'm a human being. Exactly. That has rights.
There are different ways of existing.
Exactly. You're one of the good ones. You're not one of the scary ones. You're different. The mental health equivalent of what in the autistic community you see the whole, you're so high functioning, you don't count. But that is essentially that burden that you carry. And thus, the issue that happens is that then you find yourself a bit, my personal experience has been a little bit, the more public I am about having a disability, the more private I find myself being about the details of that disability, because I then start becoming more self-conscious of the effect that that has on both people's perceptions and so on. There was at one point, like, who gets to be that one of the good ones? Who gets to be the one that doesn't scare the congressional staffer to come up with that person? Is it the one with the law degree or the one who has a blazer? Is that what makes me less scary? If you want to get to have that access, if you want to get to be openly crazy, basically, in such a space, in such a hyper-privileged space, you have to look normal. You have to not be scary. And thus, that creates a situation where the whole, oh, you're so inspirational, bullshit. You wouldn't feel that way if you heard half my daily existence. That pressure that ends up being created in that type of advocacy where you're essentially marking out price for if you want to still be accepted while being openly bipolar or openly autistic or any other mental health or developmental disability, you have to pay this price. And don't you dare stray out of that line. Don't you dare have a full breakdown that people learn about, because then you're gonna be screwed, basically. Which obviously doesn't help your mental health.
It's a lot of work, and I think this is where a lot of people like you and I, you know, there's so much invisible labor that happens just to get us out of the door, into these different rooms, into these different conversations, into these different spaces that are a little bit more hyper-visible, where everything counts. We are being scrutinized, and sometimes it gets to be, if we really told the truth, that would be very disturbing. It's very distressing. And what's really sad is that for so many of these folks, they're still used to be advocating for us without ever having to interact with any of us.
Oh, yeah.
So it's still like extra nervous.
Or interact with the sanitized version of it. Here we're talking the folks who happily will go around saying end mental health stigma, and they're talking about depression and anxiety. But the instant you start mentioning somebody having psychosis, you might as well be dead to them. Both the whole, and that is a very broad in the disability world, I am for people with disabilities as long as I don't have to, you know, keep them away.
And again, this is all about who is centered. And advocacy is okay, but it's comfortable and palatable to the non-disabled audience.
Exactly.
And the minute you stray out of those lines, you are the angry, bitter crip. Or the, you know, quote-unquote crazy person.
Exactly.
Who doesn't really understand what's going on, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
and it's a really fine line, because I think we all kind of traverse across different communities.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of have to, like, code switch.
Yeah.
And change our presentation of self, because we have multiple selves in a lot of ways of how we talk within our communities, or within lots of different communities.
Yeah.
That we're a part of. And I think, I don't know about you, but it is exhausting to be one of the few kind of disabled women of color that are kind of out there. Because I think a lot about Felissa Thompson's hashtag disability to white. You know, we talk about the advocacy world, the political world.
Yeah.
We look at the disability rights community, the quote-unquote establishment. It is basically all white men or white women who often deny racism.
The problem isn't just when we have the whole charity model of it, or the whole toxic allyship that is so unique to disability, where I'm here for all those poor disabled kids. Screw the adults, bud. But the fact that permeates even within the major disability advocacy, that many of those are the people who get invited to speak at the events of our supposed disability community and who get the salaries and the jobs. I have sometimes come across where in the opposite side you have racial justice spaces that will be like, oh, disability is a white people's thing. You're distracting us from liberation or whatever other beautiful utopia we have in mind by talking about disability. But in a way, and as horrible as that is, and as much we have to fight it, you have to admit that the people who've been allowed to be standard bearers in public around disability don't help one bit to dispel that idea. Because what we have created around disability is essentially, historically and traditionally, a movement that is either A, for people who have the financial privilege to have had all the perfect schools, the parents who could be there fighting their ass off with the school district and even threatening to sue every other day whenever they didn't fulfill the needs, and then had healthcare all their lives or whatever other needs were met, or B, set parents.
Is it more about class than...
Class and race in America, yeah. Basically, they're almost like a vine and a tree.
Exactly.
They're not the same thing, but they live off each other. But essentially, it very much lives as a class issue, as an issue where, given the nature of it, given the beginning of disability advocacy from a charity, from a let's help the poor kids, which is how we got it to be quote-unquote bipartisan in the first place.
So let's just switch a little gears. You are the Senior Policy Counsel.
Yeah.
At the National LGBTQ Task Force.
Mm-hmm.
You're also the Director of the Transgender Doctor for Affirmative Justice Project.
Yeah.
And the Disability Justice Project Director.
Yeah.
So what does that mean and what does that work entail?
Basically, everything within the entire organization that is either trans-related or disability-related sooner or later finds its way onto the massive pile of crap that is my desk. It's essentially about running those initiatives. It's about trying to lead that particular form of intersectionality. It's technically two projects, since the LGBTQ Task Force, obviously, as operates from the framework that is slightly different from other organizations, where it's self-described as a progressive organization. It does try to be that progressive voice of the LGBT community, LGBT voice within the progressive community. So the idea of creating the Trans Justice Project had already been in existence in one form or another since like 2001. And then the Disability Project comes about once I joined the task force, once I joined as director of the TransCNC Project, where I bring in that perspective and that work, and it essentially starts becoming a separate project unto itself around creating that queer voice within the disability community and that disabled voice within the queer community, where both things are lacking, basically. And obviously, coming also as the director of the Trans Project, giving it a focus on that particular trans intersection there. And obviously, coming from my own perspective, the philosophy that I take to my position is essentially do the advocacy that no one else is doing.
Yeah, we talked about something that nobody's done before. You just recently, at the task force, launched a transgender mental health survey.
Yes.
And, you know, this is something that's really recent. And there really hasn't been a survey like this.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about the survey, how it came about, your partners mm-hmm. with it, and also the goals of the survey.
Yeah. As a quick background, there is a long history of surveys in the trans world where the task force first helped create the National Transgender Discrimination Survey back in 2011, and it was the first of its kind attempt at surveying the entire community around what are your experiences with discrimination and so on. Then NCTE created the successor survey, the U.S. Trans Survey, in 2015, which this time it carried some questions around disability, like basically it asked if you self-identify as disabled, if you identify, say, having a mobility disability or other things. And we know from those various surveys, various things around the mental health of trans people. Like, for example, we know that 40% of trans people have attempted suicide at one point or another in their lives. We also know that the amount, the level in, say, suicidal ideation is much higher. We also know that in the medical discrimination context that like a third of trans people have experienced some form of mistreatment around their being trans when they go in a medical setting like a doctor's office, hospital, etc. But we had very little around that particular aspect in mental health, like 40% attempted suicide. What happened to them next? Did they see any mental health professional, be it forced or voluntarily? Were they arrested because of the suicide attempt? How were they treated due to being trans? We had none of that, basically. And the survey is right now live. It went live in June 23rd. We're keeping it open till at least September, possibly a bit more than that. That is the idea behind it, to find out more information. And that project, it's between the Trans Lifeline and the Task Force. So we've been working on that since then. And I want, in that sense, I also feel like a lot of credit goes to a few of the interns, for example, and other people who are part of that writing, who will all get their due credit in the final document, in the final publication. I am hoping the publishing date, we haven't yet gotten one since, you know, we don't even have the data, but we've been thinking around trying to get that between November and January, possibly around creating change, actually.
Yeah, I think your data is really important. So is storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Data just in your survey, but also have, you know, space.
Yes, it has the space for people
to share their stories.
Yes, to essentially the space where you're like, tell us more. And you can go into bigger detail about that there. That's often where the most interesting stuff comes up. Since one subject the Trans Lifeline wants to find out more about from their perspective as a suicide hotline is around, for example, how trans people feel about trusting 911 or about trusting police or any sort of intervention around suicide prevention, because the Trans Lifeline does not engage in active rescue, which is the euphemistic term for we won't call the cops on you. And it is based on the fact that given how trans people get treated, you wouldn't call if you felt that you're gonna get 911 called on you.
So, you know, it's really early on, but what are you really excited about once you get that report? What do you really hope to achieve in terms of either policy changes or just advocacy within the task force or within your community?
I'm thinking advocacy-wise, since that provides us, and I don't mean to pretend that the survey is perfect, this is the first one, but I want to create that first one, that initial, here's the document, here's what we know, here are the needs, and help break that. And one experience I have is I'm already going to get burned by opponents anyway. So we might as well get the information and be able to say everything and be able to give credibility to all the voices of everything that is actually going on in the community. We might as well stop forgetting about mental health when we talk about healthcare discrimination. We might as well stop forgetting about trans people when we talk about disability and mental health and so on. We need to stop that. No, we are not mentally ill, which is also
another function of ableism.
Yeah.
We have to be the palatable trans community.
Yeah. Basically.
Why is it bad to be mentally ill?
Exactly.
Is it scary? Right? And if we don't embrace everyone and the most marginalized mm-hmm. in our communities, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
If you're not even, like, giving a shit about the people who are most marginalized, It's like, why are you in your job?
Yeah. Or let's spend millions and millions of dollars suing airport terminals for not having captions in the TV sets that show CNN at the terminal, but we will not do crap around people who are incarcerated, around queer people, around people of color, etc. There is a serious issue around where are we placing priorities, to what extent are we focusing too much on easy wins, and so on.
Yeah, and I think so much of this is, comes back to people of power who decide what the priorities are, to decide the policy agendas, because they have the closest proximity to the power brokers, the gatekeepers. Yeah. So they can cherry pick things that they know they could do well, but when things are more challenging, that is out of their wheelhouse.
Exactly.
They're going to be a little bit more like at a distance.
Then there's the folks who try to deny you completely that there is a diversity issue in the disability movement.
The people who say, hey, stop complaining because we've got to be united.
You know, one thing that has saddened me a lot in the course of my advocacy is most of the actual enemies I have made, sadly, are people within the movement. Social justice, basically. Okay. Because we end up eating our own with that toxicity of just try to clamp down on whoever speaks out. And when you're saying we need to be united, you're being downright Orwellian dystopia level. And you then have also a continual, even when unintended or unspoken, either or. People of color are the other, are the rivals that we somehow need to fight with to steal attention from them, which then permeates into I have to fight against you for attention. Screw black people, or screw brown people, or screw queer people, or any other marginalized, fill in the blank, because disabled people aren't getting attention.
And it speaks to me about, just like internalized ableism, but the, white supremacy, in the sense that it creates this kind of structure or hierarchy that we have to kind of, this false idea that we have to compete against each other, and also the false idea that somehow we just separate ourselves, or that we have to be a conflict, or we have to choose one part of us. To focus on and screw the rest, right?
Screw on the fact that you're disabled. Don't stop talking about you're being Latina, and so on.
Well, I'm glad that you exist. I'm glad that you're out there speaking your truth and really be the bridge, literally a bridge for so many communities, because we do exist in terms of people who are multiply marginalized, who have just a wealth of experience and a wealth of understanding from different perspectives. And I wish folks would just be able to understand and get over the idea that we exist and that we're not unicorns.
Yes. Even though there are the pressures that come with being visible, it's not that we were never there. It's just that we're getting more and more tired of the bullshit to not be willing to put up with it.
I think it's a continual process where our own kind of reckoning with what we're willing to give and what we're willing to reveal about ourselves to be our true selves, and also keeping private and keeping close to what we really hold dear and don't want to expose, because you know what? We don't have to.
That is one thing that is also happens. Everyone gets all inspired when you're like, I have a serious mental illness, or I have a major mental health disability and I'm here, blah, blah, blah. They stop feeling as inspired if you tell them, well, actually, I spent half of last night having recurring thoughts of suicide and so on, but here I am. They stop feeling that way, It's curious. Then they stop wanting to hear it. Then you stop being inspirational. But it also works the other way around, where you're being pressured into, tell us your story. Well, no, I don't have to tell you that story. I don't have to tell you the full details about what goes on with my body, about all the pills I'm on, and so on.
I would love it one day if disabled people just tell their stories without the purpose or intention of proving that we are as valuable as they are.
One issue I've also dealt with a fair bit in my current roles and I essentially become somewhat of a public figure where there is often the pressure of, I want to hear your experience. And it's an issue I face sometimes, say, when talking to reporters, or where it's like, we want to hear about your experience as a trans person. It's like, I'm a policy advocate. I'm here to talk about all my expertise and all the crap I spent years studying.
It's kind of ironic because, you know, the goal of it is to humanize us. But if we get too humanized, it gets really icky for them.
Exactly.
And it's not, it turns into the stories that they don't want to publish, right? And that's a really funny thing about the media is that they have these...
that continual pressure of, this is what sells, this is what makes the good story, this is what's going to get the thousands of clicks in our website, and so on. And it continuously leans towards, you get to feel better afterwards when you cry, you read it. Inspiration porn.
One of my own personal, you know, missions is to see more disabled people in journalism, because I think that's where we need, you know, it's a huge area that's so, you know, problematic in terms of the way the media talks and writes and frames disabled people. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Victoria. Yes. I am honored.
Thank you. Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project, an online community dedicated to creating, sharing, and amplifying the disability media and culture. All episodes, including text transcripts, are available at disabilityvisibilityproject.com. /podcast. The audio producer for this episode is Erika D. Beta. The introduction by Latif McFaul. The music by Wheelchair Sports Camp. Subscribe to the Disability Visibility Podcast on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/DVP. That's patreon.com/DVP. Hey, what's gotta do? What's gotta do? Thanks for listening. Yeah, see you on the internet. Bye. Flexing it, goofing off with sex image, ass to the max, yeah. Disconnect your booty, ass go to max. You don't disrespect your duty on a blacktop, catwalk, Colfax, wax on, poster up, pole dance, romance, hats off.